slander me and to libel me, and that's what they tried to say.
How is it libel? How is it libel to ask you about something you said on the radio?
That's not what I said.
Hello again, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we're going to listen to the interview I recorded on Wednesday with former New York Congresswoman Claudia Tenney. The Republican is mounting a comeback in New York's 22nd House District, and as you'll hear, this interview sometimes got contentious.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Ian. I think it's time to have somebody in Washington again. Who has a record of accomplishments, someone who was able to work not only across the aisle and get effective legislation done for the people in my district and for our nation, but also someone who will work with the president and work with the Senate and deal with the really, really difficult issues that we have in this region. I think I'm uniquely qualified. First of all, I was in the seat as an outsider. We need an outsider in Washington. When I was elected in 2016, I had never even been endorsed by my local Republican committee, and I was able to forge alliances with independents and Democrats, and those people were all outsiders, not insiders. And I think that's people are sick of the inside game in Washington. My opponent, contrasted to me, was handpicked by former Speaker Sheldon Silver to run for the seat. He is a close ally of Andrew Cuomo, and he is one of the people who is, you know, either rubber stamped or voted for or co-sponsored a lot of the legislation in Albany, almost all of it, that is negatively impacting our region and especially this district. High taxes, high regulations, corporate cronyism, that is a signature of Governor Cuomo's derailment of this region and hurting our small business community. I'm a small business owner. My family business was founded right in the heart of the New York's 22nd district. Not by my choice, but I ended up having to struggle as a single parent, had to take care of my parents. I live across the street from the house I grew up in, so I know what it's like to be the so-called sandwich generation, caring for my aging parents who were both elderly and in poor health, and taking care of my son and getting him through school. And I understand and I can relate to the people in this community who have been through so many difficult times economically, personally, and I think that I can bring that sensitivity and the strength as also as an attorney and as a business owner on what helps us bring our jobs back. And the tax cuts that the president championed through the House and the Senate, as well as the regulatory rollbacks that we had, the increased funding to help with the opioid crisis, to really work on prevention, to help families to solve this problem, to work against some of the drug companies that were really just profiting off of the opioid crisis, you know, not through litigation as a lawyer, but through regulatory regimes. I think those are some of the things that I've stood for. My son now today is an active duty Marine. He's a captain. He's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. We have over 50,000 veterans in this community. We once had Griffiths Air Force Base. Sadly, we lost it under the tenure of a prior congressman. We have maintained some of our defense installations, but me working with my colleagues in the House when we were in the majority and with the Senate and with the president, we were able to bring historic resources to this region, to the Air Force Research Lab, our DFAS site, and many other installations around the region, including community service block grants were raised by 10%. Community development block grants were restored. The historic tax credits, which were part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, helped this region. So a lot of things were done. And I fear that we're slipping away and we're going to lose those things as my opponent, Anthony Brindisi, literally has one of the most liberal members records in Congress. And he's masquerading as a moderate, which he's not based on his voting record. The famous self-proclaimed socialist, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, incredibly has a more conservative record and votes more with President Trump than our own representative who claims to be a moderate. This is not what the people voted for. I think they were sold a bill of goods that they didn't get. He is yet to produce any substantive legislation that has impacted our community. He does a lot of press conferences and press releases, but he really is more of a show pony than a workhorse. And I think we need a workhorse that's really out there understanding the needs of small business. They create almost 90% of the jobs in our region. He's been behind some of Governor Cuomo's biggest corporate cronyism, whether it's the Buffalo Billion, the Startup New York, you know, the failed program of corporate welfare that Governor Cuomo put through. Those are things he supported in Albany, and hopefully those things won't happen in D.C. And we're looking at a situation where as I walk across this region and travel across this region, the number one thing that people are saying to me right now is we need somebody in there that's going to do something and stand tall for our community, not someone that's going to hem and haw and wait and waver, doesn't know if they want to do impeachment or not. And really, a lot of people are tired of all this impeachment and endless investigations. They want to see something done. They want to see, you know, a fair shot for our community. And unfortunately, Mr. Brindisi is just not producing on that score.
Okay, let me get you on some specifics here. First of all, the Brindisi campaign says that the voters in New York 22 have rejected you in a year when the president who campaigned for you carried the district by a wide margin. The Republican incumbent, you, still lost to a Democrat. So why is that wrong in your estimation?
Well, first of all, in 2016, I won a race as a complete underdog. You understand, he is the quintessential insider in with the establishment.
Well, I mean, in fairness, though, you were both in the state assembly before going to Congress.
Exactly, but I was in the minority. I was the first member of the state assembly to stand up and call for the resignation of Sheldon Silver, not over some of the scandals that occurred in 2014 and 15, but in 2012 when Sheldon Silver actually used hush money to cover up sexual harassment claims. And I stood up to him. And Anthony Brindisi, as reported in our local newspaper, was the very last local politician to stand up to Sheldon Silver. So let's get back to the difference here. In 2016, as an outsider, as someone who had to fight the insiders in both the Republican and the Democratic Party, I won a primary with $200,000. And my opponents, I had two opponents, had $3 million. I was able to move on to the general election. All told, for the entire year, I had less than $2 million or $3 million. My opponents, two near billionaires, one guy, a Silicon Valley billionaire, an independent funder, spent $4 million. The Democratic candidate, whose father was founded a company that's a multi-billion-dollar company today, had $9 million, and I still won in a three-way race by 7 points. And in 2016, garnered more votes in a tough three-way race with no resources. And I got more votes in 2016 than Anthony Brindisi got defeating me last year. And he had $15 million, a record for our region. No other candidate has ever had that kind of money. The most ever was Kim Myers in 2016 when she had $9 million. He had $15 million. I maybe had like $3.5 million, almost $4 million, and I had some outside money. But I still, as an underdog, narrowly lost in a race where the turnout was low compared to a presidential year. A lot of the Republican voters didn't come out. He had, and I'll give him credit, he raised a lot of money and he had a very strong resist movement. People were coming in from all across the country. Huge money was coming in for a ground game that we couldn't compete against. I think this year people are realizing exactly what was going on. I think a lot of the environment in 2018, 41 Republicans lost. 41 good Republicans. We were outspent and outmaneuvered by the Democrats. And we also had the sword of Damocles hangovers, the famous Mueller report. And the Democrats are trying to recreate that scenario with Ukraine and some of this other, the second impeachment round that we're going through now. So I think the environment is different. I think people are starting to realize that the Democrats are really just obstructionists. They're trying to take this president down at any cost. This president won the district by almost 16 points, and he's going to be on the top of the ticket, and he will win this race. I think the president helped me a lot coming in. I've been highly critical of the president all the way through the primary and the general election and throughout, but I think I agree with his policies. I don't necessarily always agree with his style, but I think that he does get things done, and he has changed dramatically. I see a glimmer of hope as a small business owner in this district. I see a difference based on the policies that we put forth in the 115th Congress. And I am concerned, as are many business owners and people who are in this district, that a weak person like Anthony Brindisi, who doesn't support the speaker in his own party because he made a pledge not to, because he didn't want to offend Republicans, who doesn't really take a stand on anything, who doesn't really submit significant legislation, and likely won't get anything done but hemming and hawing and wavering on impeachment and slicing and dicing words. He says everything but impeachment, but doesn't take a stand on really anything. And I think the people recognize that, and they want to have someone in who's a champion. I've never had the resources. I've never had the ability to really introduce myself. I'm not wealthy like the Brindisi family. I struggled as a single parent and a small business owner. I'm not from a wealthy family like he is. And also, we didn't have the resources. And also, I'm an underdog. I come in from, I'm not in favor with the insiders in both parties. So I think that, am I a long shot? I was a huge long shot in 2016. No one thought I was even going to win the primary. So, it's a risk to take, but I think that people are recognizing maybe we should take another look at Claudia Tenney and who she really is, that we didn't know before. I mean, I would argue that I was libeled and slandered for the last couple of years, and I really just haven't had the resource to do it. I'm going to go back to my grassroots style campaign in 2016. I'm going to have a little more time to do it. We're going to be fighting and introducing me to the people. It's amazing how many people were blurred by some of the terrible ads that were run against me, and even out of Brindisi's own words. So I think that there's a big difference in what they're saying there. And so, you can label one race and say that, I didn't have the status quo behind me, and I was able to eke out a great win in 2016, and I think we're going to do it again in 2020.
Wouldn't you be criticizing Brindisi if he had come out in support of impeachment, though? You're saying that he's hemming and hawing on the issue. What he said on this show, just to be fair to him, is he wants to wait for all the facts, and he's not rushing into the impeachment because he wants to see where it goes. But you're criticizing him for the restraint. I have a feeling if he were in favor of impeaching the president, you'd be criticizing him for that too.
Of course I would. I think that, but take a position. Let me tell you, he knew Nancy Pelosi didn't poll well. Everything Anthony Brindisi does is poll tested. He puts his finger up into the wind and decides which way to go on issues. This is a guy who voted for Medicare for all, for a complete government takeover of our healthcare system, co-sponsored and voted for this, I think three, maybe four times in the state assembly, and now actually got up in a public debate with Liz Benjamin, who is formerly of Capitol Tonight, and said, wait a minute, you support Medicare for all for New York, one of the largest states with 19 million people, but then you say, oh, we can't do it on the national level. Well, guess what? After all this, people, the unions and other people realized they were going to lose their health care. So now he says, oh, I support it for New York State, but I don't support it for the country because guess what? It doesn't test well in NY22 like it tested well in Assembly District 119. Same thing with late-term abortion. He co-sponsored and voted for the bill. Moderates don't even accept this late-term abortion bill. And someone who's a moderate doesn't vote for late-term abortion, Medicare for all, and the complete takeover of our healthcare system. He knows that Nancy Pelosi wasn't popular, so he said, I'm not going to support her for speaker. So instead of that very important speaker vote, he threw it away on Joe Biden. And now where is he? He's a man without a country. He doesn't really have any alliances in the state, in the Congress, because he's against the speaker. So he's not going to be there, at the front of the line trying to make sure we get what we need for our district.
Well, he's in the majority party, though.
He's trying to appease Nancy Pelosi, or the liberals in our district, and trying to appease the moderate Republicans and even some of the Republicans. But in the end, what do you get? Why don't you just tell the truth about it? Does he really support impeachment, or does he support a serious inquiry? Right now, the Democrats are not really doing an impeachment. They're doing an inquiry and an investigation. They haven't voted to go into an impeachment on the floor of the House. So they're trying to have their cake and eat it, too. He is trying to play the same game by pandering and saying he's a moderate. And you can go to 538 and look, his score as of the other day is a 9.3. AOC is a 12. That's how much you vote with Trump in the age of Trump. Now, he claims to be a moderate. Go look at where the moderates are voting. The moderates are in the 60s and 70s, even the 50s. He is way left of AOC. Nancy Pelosi is even like an 18 or a 20. So, you can say, oh, that rating agency can go in and look at the bills. Okay, let's go to all the Heritage Foundation, all the other ones that rate. He rates very left because his actual voting is left. It mirrors his assembly voting record. In his last term in the assembly, he was tied as the single most liberal member of the state assembly, liberal, more left of Charles Barron, who is a self-proclaimed socialist, left of Deborah Glick, who authored the late-term abortion bill and is also a proclaimed socialist. Dick Gottfried, who sponsored the Medicare for All bill, is more right-wing than Anthony Brindisi was. He was tied with a couple of other very liberal New York City type Democrats. This isn't a guy who's a moderate. You have to judge people on their voting record, not on what they say and how the media on the left, you know, tries to make him look palatable to the general public. I think it's time for the truth to be told about his record. And honestly, I think that people don't really know. And when you have enough money and you have the establishment insiders behind you, you can deceive the public. And I think that's what he's done. And I know he's trying to hide. He is just all over the board, just trying to figure out. I just listened to him on a radio interview this morning going on about, oh, I just don't know what I'm going to do with impeachment. Oh, my gosh. You know, vote for impeachment if that's what you think the president should be impeached. But then the radio host said, well, what do you think about the transcript? Is it impeachable? Well, after some stumbling and mumbling, he finally said, well, I don't think the transcript alone, you know, says anything. Well, you know, this is not, let's be direct. I mean, the public wants the truth.
Well,
they want someone that's going to assess it and tell the truth.
Let me ask you, should the president ask a foreign power to investigate a U.S. citizen, a former vice president?
I don't think that's what the president did on the transcript. But if you look at the agreement, the treaty that Bill Clinton signed between Ukraine and the United States, they say in that treaty that we should be sharing information about criminal activity of all kinds that Ukraine is aware of. I would like to know what other presidents are saying and talking to him. I don't know if it's necessarily, I think the language the president used was a little bit loose, maybe you could say, or typical Trump style, a little bit rambling. I don't think he's obviously not a lawyer, but I don't think it was raised initially by the Ukrainian president. This was an issue, but I don't know if it's wholly inappropriate for the president to be engaging in a conversation like that. I'm more concerned that everything the president does and everything we do on a diplomatic basis, whether it's subpoenaing the Secretary of State and people in the Secretary of State's office, I mean, they're in diplomacy. Should everything that we do as Americans be out in the public for them to see? I'd love to see the conversation between Loretta Lynch, you know, on the tarmac with Bill Clinton. And I'd love to see some of the conversations with Bill Clinton and other members behind the scene. I mean, do you think that Bill Clinton should be saying to the key person, the guy that was the secretary and assistant in the UN to Vladimir Putin, that wait till the election's over, then I'll have more flexibility? Is that appropriate for a president to say that kind of thing to a key person in Vladimir Putin's reign in his cabinet?
Well, but President Trump is the one who's in office right now. He's the one who campaigned in your district for you.
I don't know. I don't think it was. I mean, what is it inappropriate for the president in that conversation? That conversation is released. I mean, you might say it's inappropriate. Is it illegal? Is it criminal activity? I don't think so. I'm not even sure if, you know, I would love to see, you know, what are we going to do? Should we just make all these conversations between world leaders and diplomats and negotiations public? There's a law, you know, do you know that if you're a lawyer and you're involved in negotiations with the other side in a lawsuit, settlement negotiations are confidential and not to be disclosed for a reason. I'm not sure what the president said. You know, you could argue all day long whether it's appropriate. Is it impeachable? I don't think so.
Well, but we're not saying, I mean, and I'm going to separate myself from this. I'm just asking the question. But I don't think people are saying let's release every conversation that the White House has with a foreign power. What happened in this case was a whistleblower was so concerned by what he saw that we now have a transcript released by the White House.
But the whistleblower didn't hear or see anything. The whistleblower heard this secondhand. So it's technically hearsay if you're going to look at it from our system of justice and our legal system. The law was changed. Did you know, that? Don't you think that's a little suspicious that we have a whistleblower law that protects whistleblowers who personally witness corruption within an agency? And now it doesn't have to be personally witnessed. Now the whistleblower can be a secondhand whistleblower. And the inspector general from the intelligence community can't really explain that it's a true whistleblower. So there's a lot of shrouds of real suspicion around all of this and the way that it was leaked, and that we suddenly, after, you know, all these years of intelligence, now have changed a whistleblower statute in the intelligence community. It looks very suspicious to me. So I'd like to see a lot of the facts on what the inspector general has to say. And why would we allow a whistleblower who doesn't have firsthand knowledge to actually come out and do this kind of thing? I mean, this whistleblower admittedly said, I don't know what happened. I was told by somebody else who was on the call that this happened. But let's go back to the facts. There's a thing called the best evidence. The best evidence means that we have the transcript. Why should we be concerned what the whistleblower or secondhand whistleblower said he thought he heard from somebody else when you can read the transcript yourself? I'm not for necessarily, I don't think we should disclose whistleblowers if we don't have to, but I do think it's very suspect that we are now allowing second and third hand people to make comments about something they didn't personally witness and get protections from our government and our laws. And especially in a situation like this, where the actual transcript, otherwise known in legal terminology as the best evidence, is available for all the world to read and see.
I mean, do you think the White House is credible, though? President Trump is documented to have told 12,000 lies since taking office.
Documented by whom?
Washington Post fact checker.
Washington Post has documented, and not to mention Washington Post, the New York Times has spread documented lies about me, saying things that I never said, things that I never did. So I don't know
like
if
what?
Some of these news sources are credible. Oh, well, there's a great interview of me, the president, during the first joint address in 2017. I was on a live. The president actually, I was in the House chamber. The president actually got up, and the Democrats wouldn't stand for anything except Joe Manchin a couple of times until he got the evil eye from Chuck Schumer, which is, you know, on TV and eyewitness. They wouldn't stand for anything, nothing, not even anything. And so I was on a news show, and the host asked, and then, well, actually, so the president went to a rally out in Cincinnati, and there were people out in the front of the rally, and they were telling him they didn't stand up, and people were yelling, is it treasonous? And the president go, is it treasonous? I don't know. And so the reporter on live TV asked me, do you think the president was treason, or the Democrats were treasonous for not standing up? And I said, absolutely not. It's not treasonous. I don't think anyone should have to stand up for someone they don't agree with, whether it's the president or whomever. And all I said was, you just have to wonder why they wouldn't at least stand when the president recognized families from MS-13 who were daughters were murdered, or maybe the flag, or maybe God, you know, maybe something like that, that was sort of universal. And the New York Times ran the piece and said, Tenney says, and this was trumpeted by DCCC, Tenney says people who don't, Democrats who don't stand and clap for the president are unpatriotic, when in fact I said the opposite.
Let me ask you about some other things you've said. You made a lot of headlines.
Let's talk about this. I'm not going to get into like relitigating the last election. You called to talk to me about what's going
just,
on in
just
the new.
One moment, please, because I think it's important. I just want to get you on this. We've never asked you about it before. So one time on radio in Albany, not this station, you said that mass shooters are usually Democrats. And another time you were quoted as saying that you blamed the deep state for a scandal that involved HUD Secretary Ben Carson. Those articles are now being sent back around as you've reentered the race. Do you stand by those statements?
Yeah, they're all patently false. They're all a splice and dice and smear of me. Those are now libelous and slanderous statements. If you go back and listen to the Fred Dicker interview, the whole point that I was making, if you listen to Fred Dicker, is that every time we have a tragic mass shooting of some kind, the Democrats, within an hour of the Parkland shooting, the Democrats were out screaming and saying, this is all the fault of Republicans, Republican policy, the NRA is a terrorist group, or whatever, all that kind of stuff. And all I said is, and what I was trying to say, is no party has any no party affiliation, Democrats, Republicans, independents, nobody can say that they are clean on this issue of whether there's a mass shooter. People go in and sign up for parties, basically. So what I said was, you know, they blame Republicans all the time. And in the end, if you read the quote, I said, and sometimes these mass shooters end up being Democrats. Some of them, many of them end up being Democrats. I didn't say usually, I didn't say most. The DCCC put out, Tenney says Democrats are mass murderers. The biggest mass murder shooting in our nation's history until Nevada, which was the shooting that occurred in Las Vegas, which is sadly 2-year anniversary this week. The biggest shooting in this country's history was Orlando. The guy was a registered Democrat. If you look at the list, there it's almost equal, Republican, Democrat, or independent, or revolutionary, or left-wing, or right-wing. And the whole point I was trying to say is all mass murders and all these mass shootings are not all Republicans and right-leaning. Both parties are part of that. I've explained this ad nauseum a million times, all the time, and reporters are using it. I think it's actually libelous and slanderous to try to use against me. The whole point is what I'm trying to say is it is not a Republican-only thing. I think it's you know, they're people that have mental illness who commit these horrible crimes, and they just happen to be on both sides of the aisle in their registration. That was the whole point I was trying to make. But they used it. They spent millions of dollars or used the media with Earned Media, which is worth millions of dollars, to try to slander me and to libel me, and that's what they tried to say.
How is it libel? You know, how is it libel to ask you about something you said on the radio?
That's not what I said. That's not what I said. I did not say that Democrats are mass murderers. I did not say that. What I said was that in the end, not all these people are Republicans. They tend to be everything. They're all. Who knows what they are? Why they register? Look at the recent shootings this year. Do you think that all mass murderers are Republicans?
No, I don't. But I know that because of media reports about their background.
And that was but if you listen to the show with Fred Dicker, the whole point was Fred was talking about the Democrats are claiming that it's always the Republicans. It's always their fault. It's always NRA. It's always all these people and blaming people and saying that. And all I was saying is, yeah, you know, it turns out that both sides are guilty. And if you say both sides, what I mean is the registration of people. You know, I don't think just because the Orlando shooter was registered Democrat means that Democrats are responsible for mass murders. But, you know, you can't sit there and say just because somebody was happened to be right-leaning or Republican that I am responsible for all mass murders. That's what the Democrats are trying to portray. This, they say, we have blood on our hands. Watch Rachel Maddow right after Parkland.
Okay, she's not running for office.
Gun owners. So you're like arguing with me about something and you actually agree. I mean, this is just silliness of what's going on. I'm an honest broker. I'm just trying to tell the truth about it. You know, this is the kind of stuff that gets said. You know, I was sitting with Ben Carson's guy when he came in, and he came into me the day before. It was like the day after this whole issue of the dining room table came up. And I was talking to him and I said, geez, what's this all about? And he said, look, you know how it is. When you go to move into your office, they bring you this book. Same thing with when you're a member of Congress. Anthony Brindisi has the same thing. So do members of Congress. When you go to move into your office, when you become elected, you go through a room where you pick out it, you know, whatever room you get. So I say I got 512 Cannon. I go in and they say, okay, we got new curtains in that room last year and the floor was done the year before. So here's the things you get, you know, that go with your office. You get a desk, you get a chair, you get, you know, a couch or whatever. And they say to you, here's what's in the office. They don't have a price tag on these things when you're looking at them. I'm assuming they're recycled. There's stuff that comes, you know, one from one office to another. And I say, I'm going to get this one. And his aide was explaining to me that his wife said, you know, I don't know what I want to pick out. Pick this out. And then he picks it out. And somebody discloses, oh, by the way, this table costs whatever, $17,000. At the time that Mrs. Carson, they didn't know what it was. But somebody in the deep state or somebody, you know, we were talking about someone that was in the bureaucracy, maybe the architect of whoever handles the administration or the executive branch, picked it out. And you can go in and see every single executive branch, a cabinet holder from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama to President Bush to President Trump, and every member of Congress goes through and picks out their furniture. When you look at that book, there is no price tag on it. And what I was trying to say on the radio show is that, you know, it was just a way to slander and libel me to say that somehow. And what he said to me, he goes, you know how the deep state is. They go in and these meaning the bureaucrats. Somebody said, oh, you know what this table actually costs? $17,000. And once Ben Carson found out that's what was happening, he canceled the order. But he didn't know, and I don't know. When I order a desk for my office, or when Anthony Brindisi ordered all his furniture for his office in Washington, there's nothing on that list. You go through a line, and they tell you this. So I think that it's really disingenuous for someone to try to turn that into some kind of, you know, oh, deep state, you know, and you know, but I know that Ben Carson, for a fact, did not even know.
But you said the words deep state, though. Wasn't it inflammatory for you to say deep state brought Ben Carson this scandal?
Not at all. In fact, those are the words used by Ben Carson's guy, who just said it's like, you know, he laughed. He said it's the deep state, which I did when I was on the radio show.
So is there a deep state?
You sound like you're very sinister. Like you're really trying to, I mean, I explained to you, I have this all recorded, by the way. I just explained to you exactly what was happening. I mean, he was sitting there and he goes, you know, the deep state. And I'm like, you mean the bureaucracy? And he goes, yes, it's exactly the way it was portrayed on the radio show in a very casual manner. I mean, do I think that there's some, you know, this is, why would somebody disclose that someone inside the bureaucracy, why would they leak out that Ben Carson's wife picked out a table that she didn't know the price of beforehand from what they tell me? Why don't you disclose all the money that's spent by all these members of Congress? Go in and do a real, say, you know what, Anthony Brindisi got a new desk for his office. It was $5,000. Do the taxpayers really need to pay for a desk for $5,000? I'll tell you a little story. When I went into the assembly and I was in the minority as a Republican, we got all the old furniture, all the old computers, all the new mahogany desks and all the new computers all went to the Democrats. And I had a 10-year-old computer for my staff to use on the desk, which was, we were grateful to have anything. And they had state-of-the-art, brand-new computers with, you know, faster speeds and higher, big screens and everything. They got all that because they were in the majority. I don't think any of it's right. I don't think that we should be spending a ton of money on things like that. But the whole point of it was, you know, I just think to attack Ben Carson over this stuff, why would you? Okay. Why didn't we attack every other member of the cabinet from years past for the things they picked out? I think he was innocent.
I mean, we've taken a lot of time here. I want to get you on one more issue. You mentioned it earlier when you talked about your tenure in Congress, the tax reform bill that the Republicans shepherded through in 2017. I think, if I'm listening to you correctly, have championed that and the results for New York 22. Governor Cuomo says that it's really cost New York, and the loss of the state and local tax deduction has hurt New York to the tune of $14 billion. Now, is that something that you would look at again if you were reelected to Congress, that particular provision?
Governor Cuomo sued the federal government, over the loophole. The SALT deduction is a loophole. It's a loophole for the wealthy. Wealthy people who have expensive properties, high taxes, get to deduct that instead of paying taxes on it. The SALT deduction I fought to retain. I did an article in the Wall Street Journal about, it was called Please Pass the SALT, about keeping the SALT deduction. I met with not only the president, the vice president, Kellyanne Conway, a number of people. We fought tooth and nail to keep the SALT deduction. But to be honest, the SALT deduction is for wealthy people. People typically, unless you're in a real unusual situation where you have high, you know, you own a piece of property that's very expensive. In my district, the Tax Foundation and other nonpartisan groups have determined that 95%, and it's still true today, 95% of the people in my district, where I represent people, where I'm voted in, those people got a tax cut because middle and lower income taxpayers were there. Our small businesses were able to get some benefit and now are creating jobs. Now they have more jobs available than we have people applying. That's a good thing in my district because we've been struggling for many, many years because of the high taxes. So a lot of small businesses that do pass through, by the way, 90% of the businesses in my district and 90% of the jobs created in my district are from small businesses, not from big corporations. We once had a lot of big companies here. We once had a defense installation. We had Griffiths Air Force Base. So the difference is, yes, the tax cuts have done a great thing for our small business community, for our lower and middle income taxpayers. We also had an historic tax credit, which I fought to keep. It was not easy. Gary Cohn at one point told me, you're never getting your SALT and you're not getting your historic tax credit. I literally stood in the line at the White House Christmas party with Kevin Brady, the former chairman of Ways and Means, and put him on the phone with the Binghamton mayor to tell him how compelling and important it was to keep the historic tax credits. And we got it kept, and it was really helpful to New York. So, yeah, Governor Cuomo does not want the wealthy people from New York City moving out because of they get the benefit from the SALT deduction. I did not want to see it capped at 10,000, but I had to make a vote on who do I choose, millionaires and billionaires in New York City or the people in my district who are gaining from this. We don't have a lot of millionaires and billionaires, very few in my district, mm-hmm. and we don't have any billionaires that I know of. But I mean, this is the decision that we had to make. When you have to make hard decisions when you vote on a bill, but there was enough of it that I thought was good. Even the Post Standard, which is a left-leaning bill, newspaper up here, supported it, and it's been good for our region. And unfortunately for Brindisi, people, he probably walked when he talks about Brindisi at your business. The number one thing that gets said to me, and I've been probably toured over 100 businesses, and then including roundtables and conversations, maybe another 100 or 200 businesses. All of them, not a single one, has complained about the tax cut. In fact, on a live interview with one business, out of nowhere, the reporter asked him how the tax cut was, and on live TV said, "I love the tax cuts. It's been great for our small business." And so it's been a good thing for our small business and our and the people in my it got to the people that really needed it. And, as far as like the SALT deduction and changing it in New York City, where a lot of wealthy people live, it probably hasn't been the best thing, which is probably why like people like Lee Zeldin and Peter King and others voted against it. But, we don't have expensive housing stock here. We don't have people that make high incomes that are so impacted by that.
Okay.
But in the end, wealthy people pay more. So that's what the Democrats say. We got to get rid of loopholes. They've said this for decades. We've got to get the wealthy people to pay more. I mean, what's more fair than having a tax cut and getting rid of the loopholes?
Last thing. There's three other Republicans who have announced that they want to run in this primary. How will you win the primary, even though you're focused now on a potential general matchup with Brindisi?
The same way I've won every other primary. It's going to be hard work and getting out to the people. I've already beaten George Phillips in 2016. We'll see. I don't really know the new contender, Steve Cornwell. I've met him. I know he and his wife were adoring and supportive all last year when I was running and showed up at all my events. At least his wife did. He put out a comment, from his consultant. I hope that he develops a little more courage and actually puts out his own comments instead of hiding behind a consultant. But I'm sure that it'll be, a tough primary. It always is, because there is an establishment in the Republican Party, in the insiders, and especially in Oneida County, that are, in with Governor Cuomo and, part of the gang here. So I don't suspect that they're going to change their tune. But I've always had a primary except for 2018.
Claudia Tenney, I want to thank you for giving us all of this time. And I think that's a really important part of this process that sometimes has been lost in the way we do things nowadays. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks for listening. Stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. Till next time, I'm Ian Pickus.